Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex.
And welcome back to On Air, everybody. Alex, you've had quite the exciting and busy few days. I know just this morning you were at quite a cool event, right?
Yeah, so this was the world's first Gulfstream G700 delivery, two of them, and they've been delivered to Qatar Executive here in Doha. So they're the launch customer, world's first, of what is a slightly bigger version of Gulfstream's flagship private jet. So yeah, it's a beautiful, chic aircraft capable of flying up to 15 hours. It's decent. How was your week so far?
Decent. Just decent. I've never flown a private jet, and we reacted to this several episodes ago. You're like, what? And I'm like, excuse me, most people have not flown a private jet. Obviously, this week we had a very widespread story about turbulence on Singapore Airlines. And before we get to that, isn't turbulent? I mean, the smaller the airplane, the more you feel turbulence. So I've always thought like all these billionaires are flying around in private jets, but don't they get really, really bumpy if the weather is bad?
Well, what you're forgetting is they tend to fly much, much, much higher than a commercial airline jet. So they are usually almost always flying above that kind of weather. So it's smoother. Yes, you feel it more in a smaller aircraft, but that aircraft, for example, a G700 that I was on today, that's not flying at 32,000 feet, 35,000 feet. It's flying at 51,000 feet. So, you know, it's very, very smooth up there with the curvature of the earth. And yeah.
Can you see the... Yeah, you can see it, right? Out the window, the curvature?
Yeah, yeah. So I've definitely noticed it a few times. Sorry, flat earthers, but, you know... Also, I understand that the on-air listener base are intelligent people, and so I'm assuming we're all on the same page about the Earth being a sphere. Yeah. And anyway, definitely you can see the curvature of the Earth when you're flying at that altitude. And I guess this is a nice opportunity for someone to say, I don't believe you. You have to take me on a private jet, and then I'll decide for myself.
Okay, so. I don't believe you, Alex. I think I need to go in the G700 real quick and give it a try.
Welcome.
Yeah, so for those of us who fly commercially, this week, or just yesterday, today's Wednesday, we're recording, we had the story break about Singapore Airlines flight 321, very satisfying flight number, by the way, from London to Singapore, which encountered turbulence as it was heading basically over Myanmar, Thailand, that area, after departing Heathrow the night before. And this... You know, we hear about these incidents quite often, severe turbulence. Some people end up sort of flying into the ceiling. Usually there are mild to moderate injuries. Very rarely is someone seriously injured, and much more rare than that does someone die, which unfortunately a 73-year-old British man did on this flight yesterday. And every person I know, every person I've met went, Dan, oh my God, what's this? You always tell me turbulence isn't dangerous. You tell me, you know, you tell me I won't crash. It's fine. And then I'm like, the plane, did it crash? No. We're talking about a Singapore Airlines 777-300 that was in the final hours of its flight.
It was over the Bay of Bengal, which of course is between India and then all the other countries on the other side. When I say the Bay of Bengal, do you associate that with turbulence?
Well, yes, in the sense that, you know, that part of the world tends to experience more...
But specifically that bay.
I don't specifically think of that when I think flying over Bay of Bengal. Maybe because I do it so often that to me it's just like I've never even had moderate turbulence flying over the Bay of Bengal.
Okay, so what's funny is I do associate the Bay of Bengal with turbulence and I'm always aware of it. And even just flying back from Bangkok to Doha, one of my friends on board said to me, oh, are we flying over the Bay of Bengal now? I said, yeah, like literally, you know, after 45 minutes. And he said, oh no, I hate that. It's always turbulent. And I was just amazed that someone who's not in aviation had that association. But I have always known that it's a, pilots know this as well, that it's an area where a lot of weather can gather different pressures, tropical climates and so on, and that can lead to increased turbulence. And I myself have experienced 2.5 seconds of what was categorically severe turbulence over the Bay of Bengal on an Etihad A380 from Sydney to Abu Dhabi. And in the middle of the night with no warning or build up.
Wow.
It was the middle of the night and it was bing and then whoa, like literally the aircraft going crazy, being thrown about in turbulence. Anyway, I'm not here to talk about that. Let's focus on this and what had happened. So this Singapore 777 is over the Bay of Bengal, which by the way, thousands of aircraft cross every single day and can be completely uneventful and smooth. And I don't want to freak anyone out thinking that if they fly to Asia and they're crossing this, it means it's guaranteed turbulence. It's absolutely not. Okay, please, it's more
listen
often than not,
me.
It's fine. Yeah, listen to Dan. Dan doesn't even associate it because he doesn't, because he's never felt it, which is fantastic. And even coming back last week, and that was only a week ago from Bangkok or whenever, it was an extremely, extremely smooth flight, including over the bay. Anyway, this Singapore aircraft is over. And what we know now, and we know this from reports from passengers and also from the airline itself, is that the seatbelt sign was switched on. And around 3 seconds later, the aircraft encountered severe turbulence. And the aircraft was thrown around and descended and then climbed and was ultimately pushed up and down because that's the sensation of turbulence. Hundreds of feet, which would have been extremely uncomfortable with G-forces and so on. When I looked at some of the granular data that was released, that wasn't going to be anything the sort of comfortable. Now, it's also incredibly dangerous. Is it dangerous for the flight itself? No. And Dan just alluded to that. This is not so. That's funny. Were people messaging you saying, you said it's safe, but look what happened?
Yeah.
I had that from relatives, aunties, cousins, friends, everyone, colleagues. And I'm saying, yeah, but look, the aircraft was absolutely fine. Look at, understand the risk. The risk is you.
Yeah.
The risk is you, God forbid, bumping your head, you being thrown into the seat in front, you. And much of that risk is eliminated by simply having your seatbelts fastened. Yeah. Easier said than done. You know, and it's not, you can't be seated all the time. You need to go to the lavatory, you need to get something out of the locker. You know, the crew is standing for most of the flight. And so what we know is that when the seatbelt sign was switched on and the severe turbulence occurred, this cabin was thrown into chaos and everything was thrown up and in reverse. And it was just horror movie-esque. And there are dozens, over 70 people hospitalized, many with critical injuries, and they're described as critical injuries. There are others with busted noses, broken bones. And again, it's because they were impacting different parts of the aircraft. Do we know for sure that it means that they are the ones that didn't have their belts on? It's too early to know that. But this was really something unusual and the severity of it was unusual, and one passenger was pronounced dead upon arrival, and it seems that it was concluded he went into cardiac arrest, so a heart attack. Was that because he had impacted the ceiling because he didn't have his belt on? Did he have his belt on, but the shock of the scenario? We don't know, but it was pretty awful stuff.
Yeah. My grandma was saying yesterday, she came over for dinner and she was saying if that happened, she would die of a heart attack. So literally, that's what she said. Cool. So it's just different people. And I was thinking, you know, I flew the Emirates A380 to celebrate mine and Oscar's birthdays. And there you can spend half an hour in the bathroom with the shower. So yeah, you talk about being seated with your seatbelt, but that's the one situation where you're really not, you know, strapped in for a very long time. Otherwise, yeah, it's good to, usually when I go to the bathroom, I try to even if it's slightly bumpy, I try to hold on to the handle, which is always in the bathroom, just as like a precaution, you know, in case the turbulence gets worse. But I think in this case, it's just a really good reminder to everyone. What you can do is keep your seatbelt fastened when you're sleeping, whenever you're in your seat, and the risk of anything happening will be so minimal. And I try to remind everyone that even if you're worried about this specific risk, that the aircraft won't crash, but I'll go flying somehow because I'm going to the bathroom or whatever happens on a flight due to turbulence, I say, we've had one person die, even on this flight, one person passed away. There are thousands, tens of thousands of flights every single day, and many of them encounter turbulence. But do people die? No. So even though this happened, I take it as a reminder to wear your seatbelt, but you don't have to be scared. I'm not any more scared or worried about turbulence than I was before.
And remember, there's a reason why this is newsworthy. It's newsworthy that even before someone had suffered there had been a fatality, it's newsworthy that an aircraft encountered such severe turbulence, because thankfully it's so rare, right? So that's why it's being shared everywhere, because thankfully it doesn't happen. And I know there are many people that now think, what is going on with aviation? One headline after the other. Again, the media are skewing this a bit. I don't mean this scenario with Singapore, but specifically with Boeing, for example, because they know that you, the public, have been seeing how Boeing is having its challenges right now and it's in crisis. Well, then they're making sure they let you know about every single emergency landing that was already happening before, but they just started to report on it now. And so somehow in your head, you think, oh my God, it's increasing. It's not. It's just that a lot of the main part of the media is now focusing on everyday operational issues that global aviation faces.
Yeah, and that's something that I sent you that video the other day from a certain news channel, that it's just gone way too far, this obsession over safety, and especially Boeing. And I saw so many people commenting, was it a Boeing plane? Was this a Boeing plane? And this has nothing to do with it being a Boeing plane. It could have been any type of manufacturer that was impacted by this. And we see news sources trying to highlight that as well and trying to profit of this wave of people being concerned about flying, which is
unfounded. From the fact that they know that people are concerned. And this is, you know, as I say, this occurrence with Singapore, incredibly rare. By the way, fly absolutely fine. You know, no risk to the aircraft itself or to the nature of its flight, and made a safe emergency landing diversion to Bangkok in order to be able to treat the injured passengers. The passengers were those that were injured. And the crew, they were the ones that were facing a level of risk of ultimately, for example, if they were not strapped in at that time, or if they happened to be out of their seat, or their seatbelt was perhaps too loose, or something. There are so many different things. But luckily, if you're anyone looking for the answer here into how to go to sleep knowing, okay, it's fine. They said that turbulence is absolutely fine, and an aircraft is able to withstand far, far more severe than what, thankfully, we encounter on the earth every day. Then know that you can sleep easy, thinking that so long as you have your seatbelt fastened as much as you can, doesn't have to be tight, just fastened, then you know that you're eliminating much of that risk.
Yeah, and one last point on this. Just as a Thailand lover, I have to say, I find it quite comforting and lucky for the passengers that they could divert quite conveniently to a place like Thailand, because there's so many parts of the world they could have been flying over where the diversion could have been a lot scarier. They would have had access to a lot worse healthcare. And all those have, it's like we've spoken about so many times how in the past few years I've become so conscious over which country am I flying and what are the implications if I need to divert and this and that. So, you know, being able to divert to a place where most nationalities are welcome, they have high quality healthcare, there's no security risk, those types of things are also a, you know, a very nice bonus in this case, especially considering, you know, all the regions they crossed over and me, you know, having flown just over Afghanistan a couple of weeks ago, lots to think about.
Absolutely. I want to talk to you about a wider kind of subject that's linked with this, which is what you think the level of adherence, the level of respect that is given to a switched on fasten seatbelt sign is around the world, how it differs around the world, because you and I fly extensively enough to know that it absolutely does differ. And my perception would be that if you fly in Europe, let's say you're on a British Airways flight or an Iberia flight or whatever, and the captain turns on the fasten seatbelt sign due to potential turbulence ahead or due to the turbulence that you're passing through, I would say that the way that they spring into action and the way that it is respected is a far more, I mean, there is far more adherence to it than, for example, I think in Asia. I think they're very relaxed about it in Asia, which is funny because the opposite is true in different areas of society, right? Asia take things so much more seriously than the Europeans are relaxed about. But I just think that, for example, a British Airways pilot, you'll go through light turbulence and he'll come on and say, ladies and gentlemen, just passing through turbulence. I'm going to switch on the fasten seatbelt sign. It should be about 15 minutes. It's just for your safety. The crew are now going to pass through and check that your seatbelts are fastened. And I might need to suspend the service for the crew. Should only be about 12 to 15 minutes. So I'm going to update you on the other. And it's like this thorough update that everyone, and the lavatories will be out of use at this time. The cabin crew will be locking them. And this is all for your safety and blah, 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 blah. And yet I feel like when you fly intra-Asia, for example, flying from South Korea to Bangkok, we did have some turbulence. And I mean, everyone just ignored it. I mean, the seatbelt sign was on. People went to the lavatory. The crew were like, oh, do you want to come and get it from here? You know, like whatever. Yeah. The crew were actively encouraging somebody to get up. And I was thinking, we're in quite a patch at the moment. And this could very easily dip into something a little more, you know, moderate. It only takes one dip, you know, what do you think?
So this is interesting. My perspective is actually quite different on this. I don't remember if I said a few weeks ago when I was flying BA from Kenya to London to Miami, one thing I loved about it was that even though there would be occasional chop, the pilots didn't just immediately turn on the seatbelt sign, come and make an announcement. Because the thing I feel about Singapore Airlines, for example, is that there tends to be kind of an abuse of the seatbelt sign where if you turn it on too many times and for too long, people will start ignoring it. So the effect is kind of diluted. And every single time it's turned on Singapore Airlines, they say, they make an announcement and then they go, the suspension of hot drinks and foods will be, or the service of hot drinks and foods will be suspended until the seatbelt sign has been turned off again. And then you sit and feel, what are we going through? This is nothing. How are they suspending the service for this? So I feel like in that way, people become more just immune to the effect of it rather than using it when you really need it. And in the case of this
maybe our two things are linked then. Maybe what you've just identified is the root why they kind of lack adherence to it.
It could be that. And in the case of this Singapore Airlines flight, or in the case of, you know, clear air turbulence, you never know. So that's why you still want to keep your seatbelt fastened, because maybe the crew, obviously, the crew would turn on the seatbelt sign if they knew it was coming, as you know, in this situation, more than 3 seconds before. But many times it's just impossible to know. So that's the challenge. But in general, I think, you know, I also see different patterns in some regions where people are very unfamiliar with flying. You see people stand up all the time. Like as soon as you've touched down, people stand up. But then on the other end of the spectrum, in some regions like the US or even the Middle East, but especially the US, like they might turn on the seatbelt sign at one point, but then you see the most experienced travelers, like many more people in business than, you know, back in economy or premium economy, standing up after the sign has been turned on to put stuff in their bags or go to the bathroom because they're more chill about it. And they're like, I've seen this so many times. I know how it works. I feel safe. And in most situations, I've never seen crew be very militant about people sitting down unless the turbulence is really bad or you're taxiing, you know, to take off or after landing.
Yeah, that's interesting. How do you think it's respected in the US? For example, on a domestic flight, New York, LA.
I think people are, well, first of all, most Americans are very familiar travelers. So people know how things work. They're not going to stand up as soon as you've touched down while you're still taxiing. That never really happens. But I do think during the flight, people are actually much more prone to walking around than other parts of the world. Because, I mean, the US is kind of like that. Like, I do what I want. The crew will rarely start a fight or start some sort of conflict about someone standing up during, you know, at least
TikTok
if they're still
disagrees
up.
With you.
Well, who agrees? TikTok?
TikTok disagrees with you. Yeah. No, they rarely get into a fight. I'm like, whoa.
Well, yeah, they do, but I wouldn't say they do it about turbulence because you're not, you know, personally offending them. So, yeah, that's just how I feel it is. Obviously, everything depends on so many things, but
yeah. Well, some other kind of big news this week that happened, and not, of course, linked with commercial aviation, but definitely something that caught the world's eye again, that involved an aircraft, but this time a helicopter, is, of course, this was on Sunday in the afternoon European/Middle East time. The first report came out suggesting that the president of Iran's helicopter had not arrived with the rest of the convoy, so the other two helicopters. They said it had been involved in what they announced as a, quote, hard landing, and that they were looking for it. And immediately, I got the first ping from an intelligence agency, which confirmed my suspicions. It was about 24 hours before they confirmed it, which confirmed my suspicions. There's not really any such thing as a hard landing of a helicopter that then you lose. My conclusion in that point in my head, and of course I was open to more facts, but that helicopter has been involved in a crash and he more than likely has not survived. And of course, 24 hours later, it was confirmed that they had lost the Iranian president and the foreign minister and a couple of other officials in a helicopter crash on the Azerbaijani province area of Iran, not far from the border. The president of Iran had been in Azerbaijan that day, visiting the president there, opening a dam, and then got back onto a helicopter, an old one, 40 years old, a Bell 212. This is a helicopter that was delivered to Iran before the Iranian Revolution. And, you know, it's old. And then that's it. Immediately gone. President of Iran. Out. I mean, you know, a guy that much of the world perceived to be a complete villain.
Yeah.
Gone. And his foreign minister as well.
Yeah, it's crazy. And again, like, you go on social media and I don't know how, like, listen, this is not what my algorithm usually is, because I watch this stuff more out of fascination than anything, but on whatever platform it was, either YouTube, maybe it was Twitter actually, but there was some platform where I went in and it was, I know for a fact it was a space laser that shot down his helicopter. And then it's like a million likes, or, you know, I'm like, what is going on? This is a 40-year-old helicopter in a heavily sanctioned country that does not properly maintain its commercial aircraft. You know, you have to assume it's the same, even with these types of things. So
it's got,
there's an obvious
answer,
and I don't think it's space lasers.
Neither do I, and I don't think it's, you know, remember that Iran has the world's oldest fleet of aircraft, both fixed-wing aircraft that we associate as, for example, airline jets, and also helicopters. They have the oldest aviation fleet because they are on the receiving end of some of the toughest sanctions to exist. And those sanctions that are implemented by the West, Europe, and the US, and so really have led to Iran's fleet aging, deteriorating, just, you know, it's a risk. Over 2,000 Iranians have died in plane crashes since 1979. That's not that long ago, and that's a high statistic number for just one country. And that is because they're flying around these old, ancient jets. Old aircraft in the rest of the world? Fine. They receive maintenance. In Iran, they can't even get spare parts. They struggle to get spare parts. They try and get them via China and Russia because US sanctions, for example, forbid the export of spare parts, for example, from one third party selling a Boeing part to Iran because that wouldn't comply with the sanctions, so they can't do it. And the same is true for Airbus. And Iran only ever had a little break from this when they were signatory to the nuclear deal when Obama administration had the Iran nuclear deal, and it was where they were going to inspect and have more control over Iran's nuclear program. And as a result, they lifted sanctions. And when they lifted sanctions, Airbus delivered 3 aircraft, and different manufacturers were trying to figure out how can we get new aircraft into Iran, because Iran opened the order book and ordered everything. Their initial order even included A380s, would you believe?
Yeah, and I remember. That was quite a exciting time, I have to say.
It was. It was like, oh my God, they ordered the kitchen sink. They ordered everything. Yeah. It was like the sanctions were lifted and Iran had all this money to say, bam, we want one of everything. In fact, we want 10 of everything from both Airbus and from Boeing. And of course, it didn't happen because Donald Trump took the Iran nuclear deal out of the Obama administration, ripped it up. The sanctions returned. Iran has since also become more hardline. It had reformers running the government back then. Now it's way more hardline, and they don't care about their relationship with the West. And it's left Iran with this awful fleet that then wipes out the president and the foreign minister. And it's just like, well, this, I've seen this episode of Madam Secretary or of House of Cards or whatever. And actually, no, this was real life.
Yeah, they do. It is interesting to look just at the state of Iranian airlines. I think we might have, the only time we've really spoken about it is during our Christmas episode when I quizzed you on the different, which airlines you would fly. But, you know, you look at Mahan Air, they at least have some ex-Virgin Atlantic A340s, which, you know, I try to think about under what scenario would you be like, sure, I'll fly these airlines, because obviously a lot of people fly them. Presumably, you know, there are many other options if you want to fly to Tehran instead of Mahan Air and Iran Air and those types. But a lot of people do fly them. So then, you know, they're choosing to do that, presumably because it's cheaper. But under what situation would we, if we had a choice, be like, you know, would I rather, if I had to flee something, would I rather stay behind or hop on one of these planes that...
Why do you do this? And I'm not, we're not doing that. Listen, you can have that conversation with yourself tonight with the mirror, but not on the podcast. Like, so great. So you've put us in a situation where what? Hypothetically, we're stuck in Iran and we have a choice.
Yeah.
Of Mahan 340 or we stay.
Yeah, pretty. Yeah, something like that. You know.
No, we're not doing it. We're not doing it. Why are we even in Iran in the first place?
I don't know.
We've got friends in Iran that can visit us out of Iran. No, it's not going to work. You've got a US passport. Get it together. This is the podcast. This is not hypothetical on air. This is on air.
Okay, so luckily we don't have to face that, you know, situation. I think
reality. Yeah.
Yeah, and then I see, you know, some people on YouTube who choose to fly review these airlines, or who choose to review you know, Calm Air, for example, in Afghanistan, which, you know, I admire their bravery for hopping on those planes for the sake of a YouTube video, but that's not something I think we would just do in order to get an interesting review.
No. And you're not like that, are you? You're not chasing these kind of unusual, weird scenarios about that. That reminds me of in the pandemic where people would deliberately, knowingly go to a place where they knew they were going to be stuck because they knew somehow it was going to translate into clicks.
Yeah, or when the Ukraine war started and people would go to Ukraine in the weeks after the war to make videos and get views. That's, my God.
Yeah, well, those are your colleagues, I think, right? Your YouTube colleagues. If YouTube is your workplace, what do you describe fellow YouTubers? They're your colleagues,
I have millions of colleagues.
You need to start, having some words with some of them in, like, if there's a coffee room, I'm not sure, or by the water machine.
Sometimes it's best to just let your colleagues do their thing, you know?
And I think that's probably better. You're probably right.
This week in other news in the Middle East, we have an enormous order for Airbus aircraft from Saudi. Not Riyadh Air, which we've all been waiting for and hoping to find out what they're going to order, but from Saudia and their low-cost subsidiary, Flyadeal. We're seeing orders for 105, a split between Airbus A320neos and A321neos, with only neos going to Saudia. And it's interesting to see. So right now, obviously, Saudia has hubs in both Jeddah and Riyadh. But now we have a massive new, also state-funded airline starting in Riyadh. Yet Saudia is expanding massively with this order. And I just find it fascinating because they are really investing in getting people to come to Riyadh, to Saudi Arabia, not just Riyadh, getting the people to travel to and from the country, through the country. And Saudi, my understanding was that Saudia was supposed to remain the more conservative airline, the one that, continues flying to Medina, for example, and doesn't serve alcohol while Riyadh Air does. But we're seeing quite some significant growth. What is your take, Alex, on what this means for the future of Saudia?
Well, my first take on this was I thought it was particularly interesting that we have an order of over 100 Airbus jets announced we are around 8 weeks away from Farnborough. So if you remember in last week's episode or the episode before, I said to you, typically this is when it goes quiet about aircraft orders because they're now saving them up. They're sitting on them to announce them in big glossy PRE style announcements at Farnborough. So the fact that they ordered this they announced this order, now, I thought was really significant because I would say that looks like Airbus is quite confident as to how their order book is going to be at Farnborough. Because I would say that if they did have concerns, they would have somehow had this conversation with the Saudis to say, let us make some noise at Farnborough. It's just 8 weeks away. So that was my first takeaway. I just thought the timing was really interesting. And then, of course, it's how Saudi is just going for it aggressively, right? This is 100 aircraft and it doesn't even involve the new startup Riyadh Air. It's just going to support Saudi Arabia's wider aviation goals. So it's significant. It shows that Saudi has energy. They want to expand Saudia, the existing airline. This is inevitable expansion for the low-cost carrier Flyadeal. And they wanted it to be a very Saudi announcement because it was announced at a big event. They're having like a future flight forum there in Riyadh. And it was announced there. So it's all part of showing, I guess, that they have visions, but also that vision is translating into action. I mean, that they are actively expanding aggressively. And this is, they will play a significant role in the Gulf in terms of competition going forward. One would argue that they already are.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always interesting to see how things progress and change in the region. And we have some very interesting questions, not about this, but about other things to go through in our Q&A. All right, so Kesh asks us, what are our thoughts on Tom Stryker? No, actually, that's not his name. He writes Tom Stryker, but his name is Tom Stuker, I think. The United Airlines frequent flyer who just hit 24 million miles. And for context on this, before we discuss what we think about it, this guy, he's an American businessman. In the 90s, he bought what United was offering at the time, an all-you-can-fly first-class ticket, free lifetime flights in first class for $510,000 for him and one companion back then. That's about $1.2, $1.3 million in today's money. So quite a big amount. But he has now flown 24 million miles just with United since the 90s. That's just unfathomable. He takes his best year, he took 383 flights, and the average length was transatlantic. So that many flights transatlantic, you must spend pretty much the entire year in the sky. Would you spend the entire year on United, Alex?
I don't know if I'd spend the entire day on United, if I'm honest. But sure, I mean, good luck to him. I respect the fact that he's got a good reputation, actually, in terms of being a nice guy and treating the crew nicely. And of course, he's taken it to the extreme in terms of the way that he's been flying nonstop ever since that purchase. I'm reading that in 2019, he took 373 flights. That's over one a day.
Okay. Yeah.
If he had paid cash for those tickets, it would have cost almost $2.5 million. So the guy is, getting his money worth and beyond, doubling, tripling it, and so on, so on. But yeah, I mean, you know, I guess I could be more excited about this story if it wasn't, you know, United. But anyway.
I did some calculations knowing we were going to talk about this. In my life, or since I started tracking my flights in 2009, I've flown 1.4 million miles across 899 flights, pretty much 900. Nice. So 900 flights to fly 1.4 million. If I were to fly as many, obviously, I guess I don't take as long flights as he does, because for me to reach 24 million miles with the average distance I have, I would need to take 16,053 flights.
Wow. On United. No.
Yeah. Can you imagine?
I love
imagine?
That for you.
Yeah. No, it sounds horrible. And also you have to think about, what about his family? He has a wife. Supposedly he has kids.
Wow.
How does that work? And I mean, just the radiation alone from taking that many flights. I'm amazed it hasn't got to him yet. But it sounds like, you know, even on our favorite airlines, we wouldn't want to fly nearly that much.
I got a bit. So in the last weekend, I went to Rome, okay, to see a friend and to see some tennis. And my flight there had headwinds. So it was 90 minutes longer than it should have been. And I was like, oh, I was sighing. You know, I just kind of wanted to get there, especially if it was a short trip, and I was thinking, okay, maybe relax. You know, it's not it's a pretty short flight. But yeah. Oh, and by the way, Fiumicino Airport, love. Seriously. I just think they've really got their stuff together, and it's nicely designed now. The walks to the gates can be quite long, but it's nicely designed. It flows. It's well staffed, and it's just a joy to approach the security machines. And they're like, "Leave everything in your bags. Leave everything in your bags." It's just very, very nice. And of course, it was the 4 days of tennis, cacio e pepe, pizza, and hearing Italians in the street look like they're having fights with each other, but actually they're just asking each other about their day because they're shouting and using their hands.
I'm glad you had a good trip. I relate too. I just, you know, even if I'm reviewing a flight and they say the flight time's, unless it's first class, like if it's Emirates first class, I'm, of course, at this point, I'm still like, let's make it longer, you know? And when I landed in Heathrow, I saw our flight time was 15 minutes longer than average. I was like, yes, score. Yeah. But otherwise, no, I don't really feel that way. We have another interesting question here from Owen. He says, which airport do we think has the best plane spotting and why? Love that
question. Okay, I'm going to say what quickly came to my head without even giving it too much thought. Very quickly, even though the selection of aircraft is boring because it's usually the same, but I think the terrace at Zurich.
I think that's good.
I mean, you're so close. You know what I mean? You know the one I mean. I don't mean the lounges. I mean the one that's like a bar, and you go out the door on the left, and you are so close to aircraft. I mean, you're right there. You are right there. And I think to be able to have fresh jet fume air in between your flights, so beautiful.
Doesn't get better.
Yeah. What about you?
I get so much hate for being... I just don't understand everyone's obsession with Zurich Airport. I know you love it. I know so many people love it.
Love
Zurich. For me, it's good, but the way people hype it up, I don't quite feel that. The plane spotting
is good. The
gates
are not good. The gates are not good. For example, if you get like an A gate or a B gate and the ceilings are completely low and there's no natural daylight and it's kind of depressing and looks old. I think that's because it's the older part. But the big bit in the middle, I love that bit.
Yeah. So I will say, I think plane spotter heaven, an airport I spent quite a bit of time, actually the airport where I've spotted at by far the most in my childhood is your fave, hopped off the plane at LAX.
Los Angeles. I mean, we haven't spoken about LA in a while. I should go back next week.
People are missing. The city is missing you.
I know this avocado toast to be eaten, Dan. And if I'm not eating it, who is?
Yeah. No, but there are so many incredible plane spotting spots around that airport. Of course, famously, In-N-Out Burger, you can stand below the runway.
Oh, love.
When I was a kid, my favorite spot was on Lincoln Boulevard. It's a road that goes just to the north of the airport. And if you stand at one specific point, you're also very, very close to the touchdowns, much closer than in Zurich, in fact. And we would go, like my dad, thank you, Dad. He would take me at like 6 a.m. because I was begging to go see the A380s land from like Qantas in Australia and stuff like that. So at 6 a.m., we'd go out and see those touchdowns right in front of us. Amazing plane spotting. Of course, we have to give a shout out to Heathrow because...
We do. Heathrow, yeah, definitely. If you're not airside and you're landside and you want to go to that Myrtle Avenue place near to 27 left, I mean, it's fantastic.
Yeah, and the variety of aircraft and airlines, you just don't get that in many other places.
Yeah,
so many wide bodies. And by the way, you might have seen on my story, I just discovered the rooftop bar at the Hilton Garden Inn that's there by Terminal 2.
Were you living under a rock or...
Hello, it's incredible. Like, why have I not seen more people go there? Everyone posts from like the, inflation. You know, the hotels along like the Renaissance or the hotels around Bath Road, is it?
Oh, Bath Road, you're good. Look at you knowing your Hounslow.
Yeah, but no, this is better for me. And I realized my Avgeek heart is most satisfied when you can see the aircraft lining up. I don't want to see them just pass and not be able to see what's going on at the end of the runway. But when you see the line and how Heathrow air traffic decides to, you know, let this aircraft go, they group some narrow bodies together. So some aircraft have to hold short in one place to wait for one to pass. It's so fun. I love that. And yeah. They deserve a shout out. Frankfurt is also quite good. Paris is good. Frankfurt has a terrace with quite good views, I'll say. So
grey clouds and rain, sure. No, I'm joking. My friend is in Frankfurt right now and his Instagram story looks like he's somewhere beautiful. And I said to him, are you in Frankfurt? He said to me, yes, Alex, it's decent. It's nice. It's green. Wow. I've only ever been when it's like... As I told you, it looks like the inside of a cloud.
No,
we have a comment here. We have a comment here. Okay. I believe, so in last week's episode, the first segment, if you go back, the first segment was we discussed us traveling alone as minors, as kids, right? And that came off of the back of the conversation that it was your birthday. Okay. And we were reminiscing and reflecting on early years travels. We have a comment here, I believe, from your father. He writes in... For the record, I have it on the best authority that your platinum status dad let you and your brother use the upgrades out of the goodness of his heart. So I think here what your dad is alluding to is that he, out of his generosity, was responsible for some of those upgrades that maybe you pretended you would cheat by yourself.
Yeah.
But he was platinum. He was established. And we thank him for his contribution. By the way, I'm guessing it's your father. I don't know. Their username is New Yorker. And I was like, it must be.
Okay, so here's the thing. I love you, Dad, but Dad doesn't understand how these things work that well. So in those cases, it was genuinely my brother and I that were upgraded. My dad was platinum with, I think, Continental for a few years, or I guess half a decade, because he was traveling back and forth a lot between Europe and the US when he lived in the US. But these upgrades, so like the domestic upgrades on United, one time it happened when we were flying just me and my brother. So I have concrete proof that it was thanks to our flashy Continental silver status.
I did have a feeling you were going to say this. And so it is why it does give me great pleasure to introduce onto the podcast, ladies and gentlemen, joining us now live from New York. It's Dan. No, but we'll work on it. It could have been good.
Yeah.
Damn, why didn't I think of that earlier? Why has it taken me 50 minutes to think of organizing that? I've got a question here from Peter. He says, hi, Alex. Love the podcast. By the way, guys, can we thank you for how most of you start that sentence, that question with that you love the podcast?
Because
we love doing it. It's just that we genuinely look forward to, don't get me wrong, sometimes it's a logistical nightmare, but that doesn't ever put us off. You know, that it doesn't feel like a chore. We're excited to share it with you. We love to see the growth. And we thank you as well for those that have left reviews recently. We're seeing everything. Anyway, Peter says, hi, Alex, love the podcast. My question for yourself and Dan is, if you could bring back one defunct airline, what would it be?
Air Berlin. I don't even have to think about it.
I had an answer in my head that also I didn't think about. And I prefer those answers. So what came to your head just then? Air Berlin.
Air Berlin, because I want more one world in Europe. I want something that's, you know, connects Europe in a very central spot. Now, Berlin is quite a good airport. So, yeah, I think we're missing some competition for Lufthansa, too.
So I remember I was on a walk when this message came through, and I remember exactly a few days ago, and I remember exactly where I was in Rome, opened it, and the first airline that came to my head without even thinking, Pan Am.
Okay.
I was like, yeah, Pan Am. I would love to bring back Pan Am.
Imagine. I was thinking you were going to say that, but I think you're forgetting they're a US airline, and from the time they went bankrupt to now, I don't think they would have been what you hope and think.
Well,
they
are. Then I thought, my second very quick instinct thought was Olympic Airways of Greece.
You know, you're a one world flyer, maybe not quite as useful as
excuse me, I've got connections, okay? I would have asked him to somehow, you know, I would have set it up just
world.
Like how, well, Oman Air are joining One World and they're coming into a region where we were already overrepresented with One World representation. Qatar, Royal Jordanian, Royal Air Maroc.
Yeah.
Like we need another carrier. No disrespect for Oman Air. Love Oman Air. Love the Omanis. Terrible restructuring at the moment, but we've spoken about that before.
A little too much. So
a little too much. Oman Air gets far too much representation on air.
We talk about them more than
like they're a global player.
The world's biggest airlines, you know. So
God forbid we talk about LATAM or Avianca or Air China.
Literally any Chinese airline, any Japanese airline, just forgotten.
I know.
So
ANA who?
Yeah, literally. So, okay, one final question here, which I find just quite an interesting discussion point from Josh. He says, if BA or some other European airline had a proper business class, do you think it would be successful in revolutionizing the European aviation industry, or would it flop?
I think it would flop.
I really hope it wouldn't.
I just think commercially, they've just got it sussed. It's bloody full and they don't have to do anything. They're able to have 12 rows of Club Europe and sell an empty middle seat as business class. And last time I checked, everyone in that cabin is absolutely satisfied and happy with it. Okay, not really. Everyone would prefer a better seat, but tell that to the financial guys. BA have made more money last year than ever, and Club Europe plays a big role in that.
Yeah. So I totally agree. I think that it would be great from a marketing perspective. I think a lot of people would seek it out. But the question is, how much extra would people be willing to pay? Because ultimately, we're talking about very short flights. BAR, you know, sometimes they have great prices on Club Europe, but many times it could be like, you know, 300-400 euros for a flight from London to Rome or Stockholm. So the question is, how much more are you willing to pay to get, you know, a very comfortable seat, sure, on a 2-hour flight? And that's where, you know, the people who are redeeming points will be like, I'm willing to pay whatever it takes. But when it comes to cash, this is the problem in Europe. And that's why it's kind of interesting that other regions haven't gone that way. And I think it comes down to the fact that no one can be the one to do it first. Like, United can't just do that, because then Delta and American still have first class seats on their fleets. So in Europe, we're just in this state where low cost airlines rule. The people who want something premium are willing to accept an empty middle seat in an economy class seat.
Yeah.
And that's where we are. There's literally no other option besides Turkish Airlines, which just most people aren't going to fly from London to Stockholm via Istanbul. That's just the truth.
My friend Jasim just flew Turkish Airlines for the first time from Beirut to Istanbul to Rome. And from Beirut to Istanbul, he was on an old 321.
Yeah.
Or 320. And an old one. And then from Istanbul to Rome, he was on the Neo. And he loved it. He was like, it was so modern. It was so clean. The trim and finish, you know, the finishing, he said, was just impeccable. And I said, yeah, but you know, the seat didn't, you know, recline into full flat. He was like, it didn't matter. It was so nice. I'm so impressed. I was thinking, wow, you know, that's a decent bit of feedback from someone who comes from a market where, for example, he only flies Qatar Airways. So
yeah,
the thing's pretty high, the bench.
That seat specifically on their A321neo, to me, I like it, but I book a lot of people on Turkish because they're so, I mean, everyone in Gothenburg, that's like the only good airline option. So I book everyone in Gothenburg on Turkish, wherever they're going. And everyone who boards the Neo is like, oh my God, this is so nice. And then, you know, a few times my mom has ended up on the normal A321s. And she's like, oh, it felt so old and gross and horrible. So there's something about just the bright, modern cabin that makes people so impressed, even though the seat is fine, but not, you know, anything wow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're right. Well, look, it's been a pleasure as always. It's great to talk what's been happening in the world through with you, as well as all our other little anecdotes and insight and knowledge sharing and what have you. We welcome your questions, as always, via Instagram. What's your Instagram?
The Nonstop Dan.
The Nonstop Dan. Like I told you, like, there's another one, right? Okay. And you can find me as well, Alex LHR. Yeah, I'm stuck with the username anyway. We'll talk about that later. So yeah,
you're making fun of my name while you're Alex LHR.
I know, I'm stuck with that username. I took it when I was a kid and I can't change it ever since. Anyway. And we thank you for those that have already sent through the reviews, and we look forward to joining you same time, same place, wherever you get your podcasts.
Yes. And again, please leave reviews. It's much appreciated. It helps the podcast a lot. We'll see you next week on air. Bye bye.
See you later, guys.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
At Nutrafol, we don't just help your hair, we help your body grow it. Because it's never just about your hair. It can be your job or your deodorant or your lunch or just normal life. That's why our whole body approach targets the key root causes of hair thinning. Discover your root causes and why we're the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement brand at Nutrafol.com. That's Nutrafol.com. These statements have not been approved by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease paid for by Nutraceutical Wellness, Inc.